substantial legislative objectives. Of course, it can't be just a blanket need to develop for agriculture. There are other conditions that must be proven. In cases where Aboriginal title is infringed upon, it is required that this infringement must be as minimal as possible, and the government must give real weight and priority to Aboriginal interests in the development of their land. And there is a minimum duty to consult, and we discuss that this consultation must be in good faith. In some circumstances, financial compensation is required where there's infringement of those rights, and there is also sometimes the requirement that there be consent, the full consent of the entire Aboriginal group whose title is being infringed upon. So, I just want to make one point. I think in Del Mook, the Supreme Court has really established a theoretical framework upon which the law of Aboriginal title can be built upon in Canada. And I think there was also an important decision in the case that removed traditional barriers to litigation for Aboriginal groups when the court allowed oral tradition evidence to be entered into trial and to be given considerable weight. I think that represented the removal of a significant barrier to Aboriginal groups bringing their title claims to the court. So I had a few questions, and they were, the first one is, does the acceptance of Hong Kong place Aboriginal title in a subordinate position relative to other legal rights? And this would be other legal rights enjoyed by Aboriginal groups. My second question is, does the legal framework established by the ruling undermine Aboriginal land rights? I have read some studies where I think it was the prior case but one Chief Justice did caution that the Supreme Court should step away from being too prescriptive and describing in too much detail how Aboriginal title can be proven, what it entails, because these judge-made laws can be constitutionalized, and therefore it will become difficult to change because it becomes part of the Constitution. So, does the legal framework that has been established by this ruling sort of undermine any evolution of Aboriginal land rights? And finally, given the inherent limit that is imposed on the uses of land for which Aboriginal groups have title, how far does this really extend Aboriginal land rights beyond traditional uses? So, kind of for your analysis.
Those are very good questions, Colleen. And we could really spend another entire class trying to answer them. They're very, very insightful questions. The last time I taught a course like this, I tried to find out what the settlement eventually was, because it was sent back to trial and negotiation was encouraged and so on. And I couldn't find out. As far as I know, it may still be continuing.
Yes, I think there has been a great deal of negotiation. I know there was a lot of description of the reestablishment of the rules of negotiation between mm-hmm. I think the British Columbia Treaty Commission and the Aboriginal groups. But yeah, I'm not sure.
So, yes. Well, I think there are two different kinds of settlements here. One is that there could be a treaty signed, which really means that a certain block of land is taken out of Crown land, or sometimes private land, and actually given to an Aboriginal band. And the second is large areas of Crown land that aren't really reserves. They remain Crown land. But the Aboriginal peoples have used usufructuary rights for hunting and traditional hunting and fishing, and sometimes the use of timber. We'll get into that with the Marshall case maybe a bit. So they have these rights to continue their traditional farming and hunting and sometimes harvesting the forest. But they could be restricted if, for example, the government thinks there should be a big mine in that area. Then there have to be negotiations with the Aboriginal people. Perhaps they could be compensated if it goes ahead. Perhaps it could be prevented altogether if it's going to harm their traditional hunting grounds too much. But all these questions are really good. But I think it's too early to provide the answers to them, because since Dalgamuk, there's still been a lot of litigation, a lot of negotiation. There have been a number of treaties signed in British Columbia. There's some that are still being negotiated. There's land rights claims to use usufructuary lands that are still being negotiated. So, something to keep your eyes on for the next few years. Theodora.
Are the treaties signed in BC applicable to Ontario?
Oh, no, it's just for land masses in British Columbia. Yes?
I was just going to ask a clarification question. So then if there is an agreement that's put into place and then Aboriginal groups are thought to have rights to a certain area of land, the rights that they have then are not for themselves to decide what they like to do with that land. It's only subject to all of these different conditions. And I thought that's just how I interpreted it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they use it for traditional purposes, then they can pretty much decide what they do, unless their conservation methods are found to be inadequate. And therefore, the government has a fiduciary responsibility to promote conservation for the Aboriginal peoples, but also for others. If they think that the Aboriginal conservation methods are really going to destroy the environment for Aboriginal peoples and everybody.
So then the ownership of the land would never be sort of the type of situation where, for example, looking at downtown Vancouver, where someone purchases an area of land and then is able to do what they like to do with that land. So that situation would never arise in the case.
That sort of situation is more likely to happen on the lands that are designated as reserves than the Crown land. But even for privately owned land, there are all kinds of restrictions on use. The governments can have. I own some land in British Columbia, and the government expropriated part of it for a road allowance. Another part of it they used for a right of way for a BC Hydro line. So there, even with private land, there's a lot of restrictions that can be put on it for the greater good. So it's a complex area of law. We should go on to the next two presentations, though. Thank you very much. And who is the next presentation now? The next presenter is... is Nadine.
Yeah.
Great. Do you want to quickly ask your question while she's setting up? Do you have a presentation?
Yeah, it's just great.
Oh, it's great.
Hello.
Last question that speaks to the limit on what is that part of the Constitution couldn't be deemed unconstitutional as it relates to right to property and stuff like that. Because there are some limitations on the use, and it speaks to a particular group, right?
Mm-hmm.
If that applies to that particular group, doesn't that conflict with issues of equity?
That's right. But keep in mind that all the parts of the Constitution are equal. So you can't have Section 15 equality rights trumping Section 35 Aboriginal rights. Nadine.
Okay.
Okay. So my case study was on the first decision in the Marshall case, which took place in 1999. And I just have some information about treaties here, but we've pretty much gone over them. So what treaties were used for in terms of securing relations for trade and military alliances. And also, we already spoke about the treaty rights were given constitutional protection in Section 35 of the Constitution Act. So I'm just going to give a summary about the case. And in September of 1999, the Supreme Court allowed the appeal of a member of the Mi'kmaq Nation named Donald Marshall Jr., who argued in defense that he had a constitutional right through a protected treaty to catch and sell fish under a 1760 treaty of peace and friendship between the Mi'kmaq Nation and the British Crown. So Marshall was charged with three offenses. First, fishing for eels without a license. Second, fishing out of season using legal nets in Nova Scotia. And third, selling eels without a license. So Justice McLaughlin and Justice Gonthier both agreed that the treaty in its historical setting could not actually support nor conclude from the treaty a right to trade or continue traditional harvesting functions. So unfortunately, his defense failed out of the Court of Appeals, but was actually upheld by the Supreme Court of Canada. It seemed that the only treaty right that was secured by the Mi'kmaq Nation was the right to exchange commodities and goods in a British truck house, so a trading post. And so now the question put forth to the court was whether Marshall had the right to trade despite the fact that the truck houses had actually disappeared. So Justice Binney confirmed that the Treaty of 1760 included the right to harvesting activities and fishing, which provided Mi'kmaq something to trade with to sustain what they called a moderate livelihood. He explains just because the truck houses, which were selected to facilitate the trade of goods and services, even though they didn't exist anymore, didn't mean that their treaty right was still not intact. So Justice Binney indicated that since Marshall was helping to support himself and his common law spouse, the regulations applied to him were deemed unconstitutional and he was then entitled to an acquittal. So the main point in the Marshall case is with regards to the interpretation of treaty rights in which were used to secure friendly relations to establish trading relationships and what the 1760 treaty means today. According to the Supreme Court of Canada, the treaty gave the Mi'kmaqs the right to trade products from their hunting, fishing, and gathering for necessaries. The court interpreted this as a right to trade fish and wildlife for a moderate livelihood. The issue here was the interpretation of the treaty the Court of Appeal took in this case. They stated that while treaties must be interpreted in their historical context, extrinsic evidence outside, so outside information, could not be used as an aid to interpret in the absence of ambiguity. So now on the flip side to this argument, one, even in the current constitutional framework, extrinsic evidence is available to show that written documentation does not include all the terms of an agreement. Second, the Court of Appeal in this case made it clear that in recent cases, extrinsic evidence of historical and cultural context of a treaty may be received even without any surrounding ambiguity. And third, when a treaty was agreed to verbally and then written up by representatives of the Crown, it would be unreasonable for the Crown to ignore these oral terms. Therefore, when considering a treaty, a court must take into account the context in which treaties were negotiated, concluded, and then committed to in writing. Treaties as written documents were recorded as an agreement that had already been reached orally. Most of the treaties were drafted in English by representatives of the Canadian government who were familiar with common law practices. However, it was never drafted in the languages of Indian nations who were actually participants. And one would think it would have been done, but it actually wasn't. So Aboriginal peoples were actually also unable to read at this time as well. Ultimately, it's the court's obligation to choose from among the possible interpretations from which the treaty was made and what's in the best interest of both the Mi'kmaqs and also the Crown. There's also limited scope in the treaty rights in which the Crown believed that the trading aspect would lead to an excessive misuse of natural resources, but it was recorded that only necessaries such as food, clothing, and housing would constitute as a moderate livelihood. So the court actually set out 9 principles in which the interpretation of a treaty trade clause could be made within. And critically analyzing the case, there are issues that arise with this interpretation. The Court of Appeal suggested that certain treaties fall into different categories. Therefore, the question arises of whether treaties are to be interpreted in different ways if they're slotted into different categories, such as land treaties, peace treaties. And with that, they would also have their own rules, I guess, and like regulations, in which can make things difficult. And since treaties should be interpreted in their historical sense, then extrinsic evidence can therefore be used to interpret treaties without ambiguity. Also, interpretation of treaties must be approached in 2 ways. So words of a treaty should be examined to determine their meaning, noting any kind of uncertainties that may arise from cultural or linguistic differences. And second, different meanings which may come from the treaty rights must be considered adjacent to the Mi'kmaq's historical and cultural background. So I do have one question, and it's with regards to, do you think treaties should be interpreted in the context in which they were once written, or should the courts use extrinsic evidence to clarify ambiguity?
Mm-hmm. I felt surprised because my understanding of the Zemo case was that the application of Section 91 was relevant, and so there were a lot of issues around it, but I do agree that they need to look at the context of today, and as he mentioned, to look at the evolving law and how it constantly evolves.
Related to that, there was a wonderful concert in Vanier College last Monday. And I happened to sit right next to a professor in French studies, Adrienne Sear. And she happens to be a linguist who is an expert in the Aboriginal languages, the Mi'kmaq language, which is a bit different in Gaspé, where she's from, than it is in Nova Scotia, which is where the Marshall case took place. So she's working with a group of Aboriginal Canadians on a case similar to Marshall, but applying to the Gaspé region. And she's quite excited about that. So thanks to the Marshall decision, they feel they have a chance of persuading the courts that their rights have been violated because their understanding of the cost of the treaties has not been implemented. So really, it's a whole new world, I think,
yeah,
considering the meanings of treaties. So do you think this is right, or should we stick by Blackwater law?
I have a question. So if we're interpreting as when the treaties were drafted, mm-hmm, but interpreting now, it's not reasonable to even position them as living off what they're, for example,
yeah,
fishing and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interpreting in a modern, with old practices that aren't actually current,
yeah,
like where the conflict as far as like realistic,
mm-hmm,
like
you're absolutely
should they use
right
it as
mm-hmm
they please when it's convenient?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 1760, the native peoples made a moderate living through their fishing and so on, and selling in the truck houses. So what the court said is today they're entitled to get really preferential treatment in order to earn a moderate living. Well, is that fair? Because times have changed. And most of us expect something beyond a moderate living, although our ancestors who lived in Canada did earn a moderate living 200 years ago. Maybe all of us should be entitled to a moderate living. That would safeguard the environment. I think we'll have to leave it at that because we need to do one more presentation, of course, evaluation. Thank you very, very much. And just while Theodore is setting up here, before we go into the Quebec secession reference, the Marshall decision was once again an extraordinary decision because immediately, of course, a lot of Canadians are not skilled in reading court decisions like you folks now are, and so the Mi'kmaq leaders read the decision and thought that this means that we have unlimited rights to fish in Nova Scotia. We don't need to pay attention to the federal fishery regulations anymore. The non-native fishermen felt that they were being excluded from the fisheries and that the Aboriginals were really kicking them out. There were a lot of violent clashes between the Mi'kmaq and the non-native fisher people. And this led the Supreme Court of Canada to issue a second decision clarifying what they meant by the first decision, which was, yes, governments have a fiduciary responsibility. They can control the fishery, even fishery activities by the Mi'kmaq, to preserve the resource. And so that was extraordinary. The first time, I think, in common law history that a court has ever issued a second decision to comment on its first decision. But anyway, it did put an end to the violence, but hasn't settled all the issues there. Anyway, go ahead.
Hello, everybody. This is the last presentation of the day, so you got to be excited. I'm going to keep it short. So I'm going to be talking about the secession of Quebec case of 1998. I have an awesome slideshow, so you better pay attention. All right, so the Liberal government of Quebec set five conditions in agreeing to the 1982 patriation, two of which were the recognition of Quebec as a distinct society within Canada, and to veto any changes concerning their province. Now, there were two attempts into meeting these conditions. The first was the Leech Lake Accord of 1987, and the second was the Charlottetown Accord of 1992. The failure to succeed in these accords left Quebecers with what they thought to be the only option to achieving political autonomy. Da-da-da-da, secession! So on October 30th, 1995, Quebecers were asked, do you agree that Quebec should become sovereign after having made a formal offer to Canada for a new economic and political partnership within the scope of the bill respecting the future of Quebec and agreeing and the agreement signed on June 12th, 1995? Now there are two problems with this. There are a couple of problems with this question, two of which were the question was presented a clear bias in the way it was written, so to sway voters to agree to secession, and the question referred to an offer that was not made to which the federal government did not respond. However, despite these unclarities, Bloc Québécois leader Lucien Bouchard nearly managed to win a victory, having 49.42% of Quebecers voting yes. So, in response to this near victory, Ottawa granted Quebec the right to veto and had the House of Commons pass a resolution recognizing Quebec as a distinct society. In 1995, Guy Betrard, a Quebec lawyer, attempted to get a Quebec court to stop the sovereignty referendum. The federal government decided to take this case to the Supreme Court of Canada. The government's position was that if Quebec decided to leave, it would have to do so in contravention to the Canadian Constitution, thus risking losing support from the international community, or it could negotiate secession, which would imply compliance with the amendment procedures of the Canadian Constitution. Now, the government had three questions for the courts. Is it constitutional for Quebec to secede unilaterally from Canada? Is there an international law that would give Quebec the right to self-determination? And lastly, if there is a conflict between domestic and international law, which could have a precedent. in the court's opinion, it was noted that there are four key constitutional principles, which are federalism, democracy, rule of law, and constitutionalism, and the protection of minority rights. The court advised that it would be a grave mistake to equate legitimacy of the sovereign will or majority rule alone to the exclusion of other constitutional values. So in other words, the court's opinion on the matter was that Quebec does not have the constitutional right to unilateral secession. The court held that Quebec had no right to secede unilaterally from Canada, even if secession was approved by a clear majority of Quebecers voting on a clear question. The referendum would, however, give rise to a constitutional obligation on the part of the federal deferral government and the other provinces to negotiate in good faith with the view to producing an agreed upon agreement amendment to the Constitution of Canada. Secession now became a matter of constitutionality and not of a revolution. The federal government used the court in this case as a tool to strengthen their position as a reference strategy. And an interesting point to be mentioned is the evolution of the judiciary role of the courts in Canadian affairs. This was the first time when the courts were called upon to provide opinion on a matter that could have very well divided the country. So it was a pretty serious issue. So I had two questions. Should Quebec have the right to secede from Canada? And should the federal government have resorted to the courts in this secession matter? I know there's huge controversy over the court's involvement in this and whether even the federal government should have gone and asked for advice from the court. So any opinion as to whether, you know, should Quebec be free to go and create their own little...
Taylor, thank you for that wonderful presentation. Can we deal with the second question first?
Sure.
Because you mentioned the case that was brought to court by Guy Bertrand.
Yes.
Who was a former separatist leader in Quebec, and he changed his mind, became a federalist. Mm-hmm. And... and he was concerned that if Quebec seceded, then Quebecers would lose their rights under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And that was the crux of his case. A lawyer in Toronto received a phone call from him and said, would you possibly represent me in this case? His name was Pat Monahan, who is now our provost. So because Pat was... Well, he wrote your textbook as well. He's so good with regard to these things. The case really got some ahead of steam. And then later on, the federal government decided, well, there are broader questions that we need to ask. Stéphane Dion is the Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs. Why don't we kind of take this over as a reference question, and then we'll get all the questions answered that we want answered, not just the ones that Guy Bertrand is bringing up. So I think that the feds had no choice, because the Bertrand case would have gone ahead anyway. Do you think that's probably the case? So let's go to the first group. The Supreme Court of Canada said yes. Well, first of all, Quebec doesn't have a right to secede right now because they're not an oppressed people. But if a clear majority votes yes to a clear question, unlike the question that was asked, then there have to be negotiations. Very much like the Aboriginal issues, there have to be negotiations,
right,
in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was a wise decision for the Supreme Court of Canada? Or should they simply said no, under no circumstances Quebec has the right to secede? Or yes, they're 50% plus one vote, they can secede. Anthony?
The court was very wise in coming up with the decision that they did, because obviously the magnitude of the situation and sort of the responsibility that was put in their hands. With all the argumentation that the courts are political, it was neutral. It had the air of being neutral, but it was also a very wise political decision for the court to do what they did. Say that know they can't legally succeed, but if they decide that they want to, then negotiations have to take place in good faith. So it was a very clever political decision, by the way, because it would have opened the door to a lot of issues in areas that we've previously discussed where their legitimacy would be questioned.
Well put. Yes?
Just to ask a question, is there any discussion at all around this situation about the 51% or the 50% plus one vote? I was just wondering because I thought the amending formula, for example, in the Constitution is so much more difficult to meet.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that came up, anything about the 50%.
Well, because democracy is more than just majority rule, this is one of the reasons why the court said it has to be a clear majority to a clear question. And minority rights need to be protected as well. So that's why they came up with this. And they said, what is a clear question? What is a clear majority that's really up to the political process, not up to us? And so shortly after this decision, the Chrétien government introduced into Parliament and had enacted the Clarity Act. And it said within 60 days after such an election, within 60 days after a clear question is announced, the House of Commons will decide whether the question is clear enough. And then if there's a majority, within 60 days after that, the House of Commons will decide whether it's a clear majority or not. So it really leaves it open to the political process to decide. Anyways, maybe one reason why the NDP did so well in Quebec in the last election, that in many ways this decision has diffused for now the kinds of nationalist issues in Quebec. So I'm going to leave it up to Nadine now to thank you very much. To do the evaluation. And I will be in the absent. that's a perfect solution. Great. And here are some HB pencils.
You say you have the essays?
I have your hard copy. All the rest, I think, got the. All the comments were
comments.
So, three pencils here.